I'm Joanne Myers, Director of Public Affairs Programs, and I'm delighted that so many of you have joined us for this morning's voyage. Our speaker is an inveterate traveler, erudite scholar, and best-selling author who is here to discuss his account of one of the world's greatest oceans. Simon Winchester is no stranger to big ideas and big subjects. So when his latest book, Atlantic, turned out to be a biography of the Atlantic Ocean, it was not at all surprising. Still, the use of the word biography to describe this new work may have seemed a bit unusual. However, our guest sees the ocean as a living thing, having been born about 190 million years ago with a life expectancy that is estimated to endure for another 180 million years. Stories have been compared to magic carpets. The good ones carry you off to other places, other times, in different worlds. But in order to engage us, they require not only a special setting and interesting details, but an overarching theme to hold it all together. Even for a gifted storyteller, writing about this particular subject presented particular challenges, as Mr. Winchester confesses in the preface to his book. But being the masterful and creative writer that he is, our speaker found a solution that provided the structure he needed to tell this wonderful narrative. He writes that while rereading the monologue, All the World's a Stage from Shakespeare's As You Like It, he realized that the very same seven stages of man referred to in the speech would provide a structure, a proper framework, a stage setting with seven acts that he could fashion a coherent narrative out of a vast ocean of a million stories. As the history of the Atlantic unfolds, it becomes an incredibly navigable and fascinating tale about how mankind, for hundreds of years, has interacted and been affected by this ocean that has been central to the ambitions of explorers, scientists, warriors, and artists. In many ways, it has defined the nature of Western civilization. Beginning with a prologue that covers the geologic forces that created this 33 million square mile body of water, Mr. Winchester writes about the challenges of defining its boundaries, mapping its currents and depths, to the creative forces that inspired the art of Homer and Turner, to how the ocean served as a stage for wartime battles, and later, how trade, communication, air, and sea travel all developed and expanded. Our speaker chronicles these myriad relationships and more as he tells us how the ocean has evolved. He concludes with a forewarning that the Atlantic Ocean, as we now know it, will, in its essence, cease to be as it once was. In reading Atlantic, you will find not only a wonderful history about this bridge to Western civilization, but you will also discover just how central this vast body of water has been in your own lives. As Mr. Winchester says, it has been the focal point, an axis, a fulcrum, around which the power and influence of the modern world has long been distributed, defined, and determined. To learn what he means by this, please join me in welcoming a very skilled navigator who will take us on a seafaring adventure of a lifetime, Simon Winchester. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, and good morning to you. This story about the Atlantic Ocean was essentially born on the Pacific. Mr. Wallace, very nice to see you, as always, of course. Good morning. It was born on the Pacific Ocean, and for one specific reason and for one sort of more general reason. I lived in Hong Kong in the 1980s and 90s, and everyone in those days would say that the Pacific Ocean is the ocean of the future, and I drank the Kool-Aid, and I mean no disrespect to the distinguished New Zealand ambassador today, saying that, unfortunately, I somewhat got it wrong. I spent about a year or 18 months traveling all over the Pacific to write a book about this, the ocean of the future. And so I went from, you know, Kamchatka to Chile and from Australia to Alaska and all the islands in between, and wrote a book which, well, I have to confess, it was something of a commercial failure. And I do know failure. One of my a book I wrote on America in the 1970s sold it was about the American Midwest, so that might be the reason. It sold just 12 copies. Although I saw on eBay the other day 13, and one has... So, but the thing about the Pacific, it struck me when I was sort of reviewing why it hadn't done terribly well, is that it may well be the ocean of the future, but what it clearly isn't is the ocean of the past, at least in human terms. You had, of course, the Polynesian navigations, and you had Magellan and so forth. But in terms of its centrality to the human story, it really was not the right ocean to write about. And the thesis that I suppose underpins this book is that I think it can be accepted by most people that the Mediterranean is the inland sea of classical civilization. And if you accept that, then it doesn't take a huge leap of faith to believe that the Atlantic Ocean, very much compared to the Pacific, is the inland sea of modern Western civilization. And so really, I had backed the wrong horse or the wrong ocean back in the 80s and 90s. And at some stage, I said to myself, I've got to get the right horse. I've got to write a book about the Atlantic. Well, the thing that pushed me over the edge was also occurred on the Pacific some years later, in fact, about 5 years ago. I was driving northwards from Punta Arenas in the very southern part of Chile and Patagonia to the Torres del Paine National Park, and I dare say one or two of you will have driven that road. It's an extremely bad gravel road which drives through a particularly uninhabited part of western Patagonia. And this particular night, it was sheeting down with rain. It was miserable. It was 10 o'clock. I was tired, and I wanted somewhere to stay, but I mean, there was effectively nowhere, except I then saw a tiny little wooden sign pointing down an even worse road to the left, which said, sort of slightly encouragingly, Hostería del Río de la Penitencia, which I thought wasn't necessarily terribly promising, but I turned left anyway, and I bounced down this road in the rainstorm and came to this huge, what appeared to be a sort of Scottish castle with one or two rather dim lights, and I stopped the car and went up to this enormous oak door, and a functionary opened the door and said, yes, we are indeed a hotel. We haven't had a guest for about the last 6 months, but we're more than welcome. Do come in. And he explained it was indeed built by a Scottish sheep farmer in the 1880s, and it had been a prosperous sheep farm. Now it was fallen on slightly hard times, but they raised the Chilean equivalent of the llama, which is the guanaco. And the guanaco, he said, very tasty animal, so we'll make a casserole of guanaco for you, and we'll bake some bread, and we'll give you a nice dinner, and we'll hope you'll be comfortable. I mean, it couldn't have been a more idyllic situation. So I had this wonderful, very tasty stew, and I had shown after dinner into this enormous library with a great inglenook and a roaring fire, and I was given a bottle of whiskey, and exactly, I mean, one could not be happier, and there was this library. Every book was in English, and they said I was in heaven. So I selected one book, not at random. I looked carefully through what I wanted, and I took one book at random, one book from the shelf, and sat down by the fire and opened the bottle of whiskey and started reading. And the book so enraptured me, I was just completely captivated by this book, that I read it from beginning to end, and when I ended it, dawn was coming up over the Andes, and the whiskey bottle was halfway empty. And it was magic. And that book, which I'll tell you about in a few moments, was what prompted me to write a book about the ocean that I was not then on, which were not the Pacific, but about the Atlantic, and you'll see why in a moment. Well, as you very kindly said in the introduction, the way I decided, I mean, how on earth do you write a book about an ocean? I decided on a biography because, yes, it was born 200 million years ago when Pangaea, that enormous uber continent that dominated the world, split into two, and the Panthalassa, which is the sea that surrounded it, sort of poured into the gap between the two parts of Panthalassa. And about 50 million years ago, the ocean achieved the shape, the sort of sinuous shape that it has today, and it's remained more or less the same for the last 50 million years, just getting bigger all the time. In fact, since I started the book to when it was published, the Atlantic got, I think, 3.5 inches wider. Well, there is a group of, particularly at the University of Texas, geological futurists who, using very complex mathematical models, work out how the continents, on the basis of how they have moved in the past, will move in the future. And the current thinking, it sounds rather arcane and bizarre, but Cape Horn, if you can envisage a map in your mind, will start moving eastwards relatively soon. It'll move along the bottom of the map, as it were, across the South Atlantic, under Cape of Good Hope and Cape Agulhas in South Africa, continue moving eastwards under the Indian Ocean, will reach Australia, and then Australia will start to spin anti-clockwise, and this will make Cape Horn turn northwards between Australia and New Zealand and head northwards until about 170 million years from now it collides with Singapore. So, I mean, if you can hold that in your mind, that when Cape Horn collides with Singapore, then the last bit of water will be squeezed out of the Atlantic Ocean. And there is a finite amount of water on this planet, and it'll simply go somewhere else to be reconfigured into other oceans. But the Atlantic, as we've come to know it, will cease to be. And, of course, we'll all be extinct. And I should say, as a sort of in parenthesis here, this notion of geological time, not everyone gets it. And I was talking to a group of ladies who lunch in Kansas City a couple of years ago about the likelihood of the volcanoes in Yellowstone National Park erupting, as they surely will. And I painted a fairly vivid portrait of what's likely to happen, the Titanic series of eruptions, which will last for several hundred years, and that all the great North American, Northwest American cities, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, and over the border, Calgary and Vancouver, will be covered by hundreds of feet of volcanic dust, and everything will come to an end. And people looked sort of somewhat nervous at this. But I said, but don't worry. I said, this will be 250,000 years, by which time, of course, everyone will be extinct. And everyone sort of sighed much relief about this, but except for one extremely angry woman sitting in the front row who stood up, sort of choleric and red-faced, and said, what? She said, what? Even Americans will be extinct? So Americans, I'm afraid, will be extinct by the time the Atlantic ceases to be. So then that provides me with the prologue and the epilogue of the book, and as you mentioned, the seven chapters within are organized according to the seven ages of man from As You Like It, which, if you remember, are infancy, school child, lover, soldier, justice, old man, and return to childhood. And you know, not all the critiques are in yet, but most people seem to think that the structure more or less works. Well, what I thought I'd do was to select almost at random from this great sort of gallimaufry of things that are put into this structure, just a couple of stories to indicate the sort of the way that the Atlantic impinges on us in ways that we may not either know or have thought about for some while. And then I'll end this by going back to the book that I read in Chile and tell you why that was particularly important for me. So the first of these stories, take about 5 minutes each to tell, is sort of important, if you like. It's something relatively unexpected. The second one is less important, although perhaps in a philosophical sense quite important. So the first one, the background scenario is quite simple, and it relates to the Battle of the Atlantic in the First World War. There were two battles of the Atlantic, one in each war, and they refer to what are essentially called tonnage wars, where German submarines would attempt to interdict and sink eastbound cargo convoys to stop Britain getting supplies of grain or munitions or whatever she needed from very kindly people in North America. And the only technical difference between these two wars was that in the Second World War, German submarines were able to fire their torpedoes at our at cargo ships while they were submerged. But in the First World War, at least for most of the First World War, they fired their torpedoes at us when they came to the surface. They would use their periscopes to locate the ships. They would then come to the surface, fire their torpedoes, and with any luck, from their point of view anyway, sink us. So the fact that they were on the surface gave the Royal Navy the opportunity to shoot at the submarines and hopefully sink them. This was happening in 1914, 1915, and most of 1916, except in the summer of 1916, we, the Royal Navy, ceased being able, at least with the energy hitherto, to sink German ships for one very simple practical reason, that we'd be running short of cordite, the propellant that fires the shell from the 7 or 8 inch guns with which we would try and attack these ships, these submarines. And the reason that we were short of cordite is that we had run short of a chemical component of cordite, the chemical acetone. And acetone, most women in the audience will know, is nail polish remover. Well, up to this point, Britain had imported all of her acetone from Germany. Well, clearly the Germans weren't going to sell us acetone if they were at war with us. And so we had a bit of a problem. So that's the background to this story. What happened in the summer of 1916, C.P. Scott, who was the editor of The Guardian, Charles Prestwich Scott, best known perhaps for making that famous sort of journalistic mantra that comment is free but facts are sacred. The editor of The Guardian, and indeed this was the paper that I used to work for, so a revered figure in my life, certainly, he used to have lunch every Tuesday at the Northern Liberal Club with someone that he found interesting. And in, I think it was July 1916, Tuesday, he had lunch with the professor of chemistry at the University of Manchester, who was a white Russian chap called Chaim Weizmann. And so he had Professor Weizmann over for lunch, and they talked about many things. But during lunch, somewhat startling, C.P. Scott, Weizmann got very excited and said, I've come up with a way of producing in industrial quantities the chemical acetone. C.P. Scott had never heard of acetone in his life and found this a rather boring, if startling, remark. But nonetheless, put it in his brain where it remained. But only really had to remain there for a week, because the following week he was in London having lunch with David Lloyd George, who at the time was Minister of Munitions in the wartime cabinet. And Lloyd George was going on and on at lunch saying how dreadful the situation was in the North Atlantic, because our boys, the Royal Navy, didn't have enough cordite, and that's because we didn't have enough acetone. So this is the second time in a week that C.P. Scott has heard this strange word, and a light went on in his brain, and he said, oh, I just had lunch with this fellow, this little chap in Manchester last week, who claims to have found a way of producing acetone in very large quantities. And this made Lloyd George suddenly come alive, and he said, really? We must see him. We must have him down to London. And so he was brought down to London and interviewed by some Whitehall boffins who discovered that he was not a crackpot and said, well what do you need, Professor Weizmann, to accomplish this? And he said, well, I need something with vats or stills or something like that, large sort of metal things. And they said, well, how about the Nicholson's Gin Factory, which is in Bow, in East London, where Bow Bells are, has just gone bankrupt, so we've taken possession of the site. Would that do? And he said, oh, wonderful. I mean, a gin factory couldn't just the sort of thing I'm looking for. And what else? And he said, I need a large quantity of something with cellulose in it, and like maize. And they said, well, you can't have maize because that keeps getting torpedoed on its way over from Canada, and that's the sort of the problem we're trying to solve. Anything else? And he said, yes, how about chestnuts? And the British, as you may well know, children in Britain, I don't know about children in America, in September, October, we play a game, I did it as a child, called Conkers, where you collect horse chestnuts, you bore a hole through them with a skewer, suspend them like a sort of plumb bob on a string, and another boy tries to hit your conker with his conker, and anyway, it's a crazy game, but we played it. And the result of this was, and all children all over Britain in September and October voluntarily collect conkers. So the word went out that autumn that, yes, children should continue to collect conkers but not play the game, simply put these things into paper bags and people would collect them and bring them to London. And so that's exactly what happened. Children collected conkers. They were collected in sacks, put in lorries, which came down to London, and these thousands of tons of conkers were poured into the vats of the Nicholson's Gin Factory, and using the magic that Professor Weizmann had devised, first from the spigots at the bottom of the tank would come a trickle, then a gush, then a torrent of pure acetone, which was put into carboys, which was then put on trains, taken down to Poole in Dorset, where the Royal Navy Munitions Factory was, transformed into cordite, loaded onto the ships, taken out into the Atlantic, and lo and behold, the guns started firing again and German submarines started sinking, and the whole calculus of the war effort started to turn back to Britain's favour. And this was what was happening during the autumn and winter of 1916 and early into 1917, and then it became apparent that we were winning the Battle of the Atlantic, that no longer were we losing it. And the British government sort of collectively, sigh of relief, and said, gosh, you know, the person that was responsible for this, we ought to honor in some way. And So the thing that the British do, of course, to honour people largely is to give them knighthoods. So they looked at his name, Chaim Weizmann, and thought that Sir Chaim Weizmann would sound very agreeable. And so it was decided that he should be summoned down from Manchester and told that His Majesty's government wished to award him an honour. So it was decided, because he was a foreigner, because he was a white Russian, that this task should be given to the foreign secretary, who was Arthur Balfour. And so Balfour, I'm sure you're now all beginning to understand how this is going to coalesce. Arthur Balfour summoned Weizmann down to London and said, we're frightfully... He knew Weizmann. And he said, we're terribly grateful for you inventing this Acetan stuff, which has changed our fortunes in the middle of the Atlantic. So I'm here to tell you that we'd like to give you a knighthood, and the Buckingham Palace is asking whether you'd be minded, as the phrase has it, minded to accept. And Weizmann said, well, it's really awfully kind of you, Mr. Balfour, but my answer is no, I do not wish to be honoured personally, but what I do want, as you know, I'm secretary of the English Zionist League, is for you to write a declaration saying that His Majesty's government would look with favour upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And Balfour said, I think possibly we can talk about that. And so they did, throughout the summer of 1917, discuss this, and come November, I think it was the 17th, 1917, finally, there's a formal letter sent to Lord Rothschild, who was, of course, president of the World Zionist Federation, but with a copy, out of gratitude to the man who started it all, Professor Weizmann, the formal declaration was made, the famous Balfour Declaration, that His Majesty's government states that it looks with favour upon the establishment for a national homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And so it can fairly be said that the Jewish state, which was founded 31 years later, 1948, came about because of the vagaries of chemistry and was born through a series of events which began in the North Atlantic Ocean, underpinning the point that this book attempts to make, which is that the Atlantic infects the life of all of us, even as far away as the Levant. So that is one of the two stories. The other one is in a way much more trivial, although to me sort of quite personally and I think quite philosophically interesting. It also relates to war, although in the South Atlantic. I was in May 1982, I was in prison. I don't know how many convicts you've had addressing you from this podium, but I'm sure I'm not the first, and I'm sure I won't be the last, but I am. I was arrested for spying in Argentina during the Falklands War, and was locked away, theoretically, for life, although, as you can see, they let me out on bail, a rather trivial sum, I might say, I thought. But I spent 3 months in the most southerly town in the world, a place called Ushuaia in southern Tierra del Fuego. And I'll remember very vividly the day, it was May the 10th, 1982, when there was a tremendous commotion in the cell, and a very, very excited prison governor, a man called Juan Carlos Grieco, came up to the cell and shouted at me, "We've sunk one of your ships." He was absolutely thrilled to say that the first casualty of the war was that an aeroplane, one of Argentine aeroplanes, a Super Etendard, had dropped a missile, a French, of course, typically French missile, called an Exocet, and it hit amidships one of the prides of the Royal Navy, HMS Sheffield, which is a Type 42, I think, destroyer, and set it on fire, and it was many, many people were killed, and the ship was abandoned, and then 6 days later sank. So, I mean, this was the first Marine Royal Navy casualty since World War II, and, I mean, it was something that shocked. It's one of the events which, to a Briton, was as memorable as, you know, many tragedies. You know where you were when you heard the sinking of the Sheffield. Well, and I was in prison. So, I mean, the war then progressed, as you well know, the British eventually succeeded, and there was an end to the war, and I was released for this insulting amount of bail. Well, then I didn't forget about it, obviously, but the years went past, and about 15 years later, I think I was living in America, and I got a letter through a series of intermediaries, from Juan Carlos Grieco, this... he was an Argentine naval officer, and he was in charge of the prison. And he said he very much wanted to see me, that he himself, after the war was over, he was arrested, he was put in my cell for the following year, and then was dismissed from the Navy, had to go from house to house in Buenos Aires selling soap powder, but he managed to keep his life and his dignity and his family together, and then took a degree in history and returned to Tierra del Fuego, where he is now professor of history at the University of Patagonia Tierra del Fuego campus. And he would love to show me Tierra del Fuego as a free man. So I showed this to an editor in a magazine in New York, and naturally he said, well, this is a rip-roaring story. Go down immediately. So I left that night. I flew down to Buenos Aires, flew down to Ushuaia, and there was Juan Carlos, 15 years later, different completely. All the swagger and braggadocio had gone. He was a very different man. But he had something to say to me, and he took me out to dinner. And we ate, I remember very well, the centojo, which is the king crab, which they have in abundance in the waters off Cape Horn, and the calafate berry, which is a berry that they always say if you eat a souffle of calafate, you will always come back to Patagonia. And there this was proving the point, as it were. And two at least bottles of Malbec, and we were sort of well on into the evening. And then his eyes welled up with tears, and he said, the reason I wanted you to come back is I want to apologize. Because I am a sailor, a professional sailor, and I remember vividly, as I dare say you do, the 10th of May, the sinking of the Sheffield, when I came into your cell and shouted exultantly that we had sunk one of your ships. And I just want you to know that I feel desperately sorry. I've always felt sorry about that, because no sailor likes to see another ship sinking. The drowning in the middle of an uncharted ocean is just an unimaginably horrible thing to do. And he said, I wish formally to apologize to you, because he said there is a brotherhood of the sea. And I thought that was terribly nice. So as I say, it's not a terribly important story, but it's important to me personally. So I just want to round this off, looking carefully at the clock, at the book I was reading back in 5 years ago in Chile. It was a book by a man called John Marsh, and it was called Skeleton Coast. And it was the story of a shipwreck, a civilian shipwreck, in 1942. The ship was called the Dunedin Star, and it was coming down from Liverpool, down the west coast of Africa, the idea being that it would round Cape Agulhas and go north and up to deliver cargo in Aden. And it had 62 passengers on board, including two babes in arms. Well, the ship passed the coast of Angola, south of the Cunene River for about 300 miles. There is this stretch of coastline in what is now Namibia, called the Skeleton Coast, because it is so dangerous. It's probably the 300 most dangerous miles of coastline anywhere in the world. All mariners fear it. There are onshore winds. There are vicious reefs. There are fogs. There's a horrible northbound cold current. And if you do have the misfortune of being stranded on the coast, there is no water. You die. And the coastline is littered, which is why it's called the Skeleton Coast, with the skeletons of ships that have, from the 15th century, sunk and remained there. So the Dunedin Star did indeed strand on the Clan Alpine Shoal. The 62 people did get on shore through the raging water and built themselves a shelter, and in normal circumstances they would have died. But there was a heroic rescue attempt, not initially made by sea, of policemen coming up from the capital of Windhoek. It took them 2 months. But they got to them. They dropped them water from aircraft, and the people clung on to life, and they got back eventually. No casualties at all, not of the party. However, there were rescue attempts made by sea, and one of them, they all failed, and one of them that I was particularly moved by was a tug from Cape Town called the Sir Charles Elliot, which came up to within about 10 miles of them, but then got caught in the onshore currents and winds, drifted onto a shoal, was wrecked. Two young men, the first mate and his assistant, the assistant was called Matthias Coriseb, the first mate was a Scotsman called Angus Campbell McIntyre, tried to swim ashore with a rope, but they were swept away and they drowned. Well, I read this story, and the rescue attempt was extraordinarily heroic. The saga of the Sir Charles Elliot was very sad, and I decided that I would somehow, sooner or later, go and find the wreck, and probably the loneliest gravesite in the world. So when I was researching this book, I managed to get myself to Cape Town and got up to Windhoek, managed to find someone in a little plane that took me up to the Skeleton Coast, And there I found a local with a Land Rover that was capable of driving over the desert. I had the GPS coordinates of where I thought the wreck, totally unvisited, was. And we drove for 3 days up the coast of the very bleak, I mean, I can't begin to tell you how lonely it is, and eventually reached the wreck. The ship, still recognizable after, 68 years, I think. Funnel, anchor, boilers, and so forth there, and boxes of her cargo, which you would open them, and in them hundreds of unbroken light bulbs, which we had been for some reason sending to Aden from Liverpool, I don't know why. And there was the shelter, still there, the canvas obviously ripped away, but the places where these people had lived. And then what I wanted to see was the gravesite. And so we turned around and went south a bit, about 10 or 12 miles, to a place called Rocky Point, which is where I knew the Sir Charles Elliot had stranded. And you see in the troughs between the incoming breakers two tiny stanchions of rusted iron, which is all that remains visible above the sea of this ship, and the rest of it was somewhere unseen below the waves. And then onshore, on a sandspit, what must be the loneliest grave in the world, a pile of whale bones and boulders and a small brass plaque which says this was put here to the memory of Matthias Coriseb and Angus Campbell McIntyre. And I was extremely moved by this, and I had picked up from the wreck a small glass bottle, I think something that a woman had put smelling salts, or someone who had been on the southbound voyage, and it sort of blown smooth by the drifting sands over the half century. And there's a Scottish tradition of whenever you see a cairn of boulders, you add to it to keep it solid. And I thought I would put this bottle into the cairn. And so I unscrewed it and I tore a page from my notebook and I wrote, and it sounds awfully corny, I know, but at the time it was the best I could do. Thanks so much for trying. Now rest in peace. And I signed it with my name and address in New York, screwed it up and tucked it into the bottle, screwed it shut, a message in a bottle, which of course all sailors know, and put it among the boulders and the whale bones. And that, I thought at the time, was enough. But then I got home and was writing the book, and I thought to myself that Angus Campbell McIntyre, in a way, symbolized so much of at least one aspect of our human relationship with this ocean. He was born on an island in the west coast of Scotland in the Atlantic Ocean. He traveled down the Atlantic Ocean to work in Cape Town, which is one of the great cities on the shores of the Atlantic. He'd got a job working in the Atlantic on the Sir Charles Elliot, and he died in the Atlantic trying to effect a rescue, and then his body was somehow swept out and lies somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. So I decided then at the end of the day that I would dedicate the book to him, and that's what I did. I dedicated it to my wife, as I always do, but also to the memory of Angus Campbell McIntyre, who symbolizes, at least in my mind, our human relationship with this enormous body, this 33 million square miles of this ocean, which is central, I believe, to all of our histories. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, your words, whether spoken or written, are magical, so thank you very much for that. I'd like to open the floor to discussion and wait till the microphone comes to you, and please identify yourself, Susan.
Susan Gittleson, you are the most marvelous raconteur. But since we don't have the brandy for a lunch or a dinner, all we have is sobering coffee, may I dare to ask you about power relations as they are affected by the Atlantic? For example, you speak so well in your Oxonian accent and so forth, and we know that Britannia has ruled the waves, and that's how the American colonies, after all, became so Anglophone. And there was the time when Portugal went out and conquered the world. So could you perhaps relate to these questions of power relations and how they've shifted and how the Atlantic has made such a difference?
Yes, I mean, that's a very long subject, of course, and I know that I've only got... But I mean, one thing I should say, I mean, the beginning of power relationships, I am... This book is making me hugely unpopular in one particular quadrant of American society. I find it increasingly difficult to get reservations in Italian restaurants because I've tried in this book to dislodge Christopher Columbus from his position of primacy Columbus was not the first to cross to North America. North America was first settled by a Norwegian called Leif Erikson 491 years before Columbus, who never got here, didn't know where he was and all the rest of it. And I just love the fact that it's hardly a power relationship, but is indicative of something, that the first, not only did they settle the Norwegians and built this wonderful little settlement at Lanceau Meadows in Newfoundland, which if you haven't seen it, I think you all should. It's a wonderfully moving little clutch of sod-covered houses. And they had a child there. And the first European child born in North America was called Snorri Thorfinnsson. And the thing about the Norwegians is that they didn't like the weather. They hated it. And they, after 5 or 6 years, so when Snorri was a little boy, they decided to up sticks and leg it back to Norway, saying, well, I don't know why we bothered to come here. It's just as gloomy as it is back in Stavanger. And the big difference was, and this is sort of the beginning of the power shift, is that by great good fortune, Columbus and his crew landed in a part of North America where the weather was wonderful and things grew in abundance. It wasn't all bleak and, you know, stunted trees. It was rich in abundance. And that's how it all began. So, well, I mean, you know very well that the Portuguese and the Spaniards and the Treaty of Tordesillas and all the division between Portugal and Spain in the Atlantic. And then, of course, the British came in, Cabot being the first, settling Newfoundland, which is the oldest of all the British colonies. And we still cling on. I mean, we still have in the Atlantic Ocean, we have 5 Caribbean colonies. We've got the very crucial military base of Ascension Island. We've got St. Helena, where Napoleon was locked up after Waterloo. We've got the island of Tristan da Cunha, one of the dreariest places in the world, from which I am banned for life, but that's a whole different story. And, of course, we've got the Falkland Islands, which one has to remember in power relationships. One of the reasons that the Americans were so kind to us in the 1982 war, giving us sidewinders and all sorts of basing facilities for our war, is that America did not want a hostile and unstable nation to take control of the approaches to Cape Horn, which is why you would much prefer that a friendly government, or moderately friendly, the British, is in control of the approaches to Cape Horn. So I could go on at great length, but basically the sea is now essentially in the bailiwick of the American Second Fleet running out of Norfolk, Virginia, and no longer can the British say we rule the waves, particularly after the cuts that David Cameron announced last week. And we're losing the Ark Royal, the sort of a flagship of our fleet. So it's up to you guys. And the new carrier, the George W. Bush, that was I saw it in Norfolk last Friday. That's the kind of vessel that's going to do the power projection in the Atlantic Ocean for the next half century.
Tom, could you just wait till the microphone comes and introduce yourself?
It's a very brief question. Under the full disclosure, Simon,
Tom Wallace,
you keep...
Sorry, you didn't give your name.
Oh, Tom. I'm Tom Wallace, known to Simon Winchester. Under full disclosure, you talk about you guys. Shouldn't you reveal that you've recently become an American? And you're probably a dual citizen, but I just wonder why you say you guys.
No, because it is still technically you guys. I haven't been fully accepted into your country yet. I'm merely a green card holder, but it's on the table, and I've filled in. I've got one final form to fill in, and then... But there is a nice sort of... I'm glad you brought it up, because, yes, I'm very keen to become an American, and I think that'll happen next January. But we're doing the ceremony on the deck of the USS Constitution, which is, I happen to know the captain, and he thought it was very appropriate because, of course, the USS Constitution was hugely important during the War of 1812, of which, of course, we're coming up to the 200th anniversary, a mournful event for most Englishmen. I will walk on the deck as an Englishman, and I will walk off as an American, and I think that's wonderfully symbolic.
My name is James Starkman. I am a semi-extinct American, and I really can't understand why you would want to become one of us, since you will be fully extinct very shortly. But I'm really most gratified by the story of how young English schoolboys pulled all our chestnuts out of the fire. I thought that was really very illuminating. But I was wondering if in the book you addressed the Battle of Jutland, and I'd just like your comments on that.
Well, I do, and I'm fascinated by Jutland. The if you remember from Seven Ages of Man, the fourth is the soldier. And so that chapter's everything to do with warfare and armed conflict of one sort or another in the Atlantic, and it begins with the Vikings and the Romans, and then looks at the development of wooden ship warfare, of course the classic battle being Trafalgar, the crossing of the T by Nelson, and then looks at the development of metal ship warfare, beginning with the Merrimack and the Monitor and during the American Civil War, and then progressing to the classic of all battles, which is the Battle of Jutland. And I love the Battle of Jutland was a horrendous exchange of losses between the German High Seas Fleet and the British Grand Fleet. But what happened after the war, I still think, is if you're interested in naval history, I became fascinated by this small nugget of information that after the war was over, the German High Seas Fleet was interned in Scarpa Flow, which is this more or less landlocked bay in the Orkney Islands. And so all the ships, all these great German battleships and dreadnoughts were there. And then there was this incredible moment, and I think it was 1919, when on a prearranged signal, a radio message sent to all of the ships by the German officers, who were allowed to remain on board, of course, they were all blown up and scuttled. And so the entire fleet sank to the bottom of Scarpa Flow. I mean, it was incredibly annoying for the Royal Navy that wanted these ships, and suddenly they disappeared as one. But the coda that I find interesting is that to this day, the ships, which you can still see if you fly into the Orkneys and you pass low, oh, and the sun is at the right angle, you can see the outlines of these ships all sunk down below. But divers still go down to extract steel from the hulls of some of these ships for use in very sensitive scientific experiments, because it is some of the very rare occurrences of steel, high-quality steel, which does not have any radioactivity in it. Ever since the testing of the atom bombs began in 1945, all steel has got very tiny amounts of radioactivity in it, but none in steel made before 1945. And so you see occasionally divers going down, and the reason they're going with welding torches is to get small amounts of steel to use in experiments all over the world, because it is the purest steel you can imagine.
Maybe you could make a few comments on the importance of the seas going forward, because obviously in the past, controlling the seas was tremendously important, but with the changes in technology, internet, different ways, air travel, I mean, how important do you think the seas are going forward?
Well, hugely important, and in the chapter relating to justice, which is I deal with trade and communications and the law of the sea and all that sort of stuff, unimaginably so. I mean, the statistics still give the Atlantic primacy of position over the Pacific. You've only got to look at the number of, flights for a start. Gander Air Traffic Control and Shanwick Air Traffic Control, which are the two ends of the North Atlantic air route, 414,000 flights a year, 1,350 a day are traveling. It's like a solid highway of air traffic, but that is as nothing compared to ship traffic. And it was in the Atlantic that Malcolm McLean, a Kentucky truck-driving company boss, suddenly had this idea in the 1950s of putting things on ships in boxes all of the same size. And this man, Malcolm McLean, Malcolm spelt without a middle, L, M-A-L-C-O-M, for some funny reason, invented the shipping container, which transformed everything and enabled goods from the Far East, let's say, to be brought economically to America. I mean, stevedoring charges and everything, I mean, you'll remember on the waterfront and movies like that. Overnight, the port charges dropped from $6 a ton to 16 cents a ton, which meant that suddenly ports like Yokohama and Shanghai became connectable with ports like San Francisco and Vancouver. And overnight, the Far East as a manufacturing center got its start. And the container ship revolution is something that really hasn't been written about extensively, except in the trade magazines. Well, that was born on the Atlantic. And, of course, the amount of shipping traffic carrying containers across the Atlantic is prodigious and growing. Of course, there's a bit of a hiccup now because of the economic downturn, but all the underlying figures show that the Atlantic is just almost a solid pathway of trade. So there is no gainsaying that, and that is not going to diminish anytime soon. But there is a corollary to it, which is that the plains emit a vast amount of carbon particles, which are inimical to the health of the atmosphere, and so do ships. There's a new technology in Germany which shows that just as with contrails, not the California contrail of 2 days ago, but ones that you see behind an aeroplane, are emitted by ships as well. And you can see pathways of, as it were, smoke in the Atlantic Ocean, crisscrossing the Atlantic from, you know, Liverpool to Baltimore or Lisbon to St. John's, because ships themselves are very, very dirty creatures. And so both industries are now trying to burn other fuels and make themselves greener, as so they should. So hugely important. The internet is making no difference at all. It is very, very busy ocean.
Jim McClaig, can I say in passing that the vision of Australia spinning anti-clockwise is one that rather appeals to New Zealanders? You describe the Atlantic as the inland sea of Western civilization. I'd agree with that. But I wonder if you could comment on the suggestion that that has actually resulted in a serious 20th century geopolitical error on the part of those who determined, particularly American, but also European policy. In other words, it was the Atlantic that essentially, and the relationships of the Atlantic, that essentially drove geopolitical considerations and led to grievous errors in relation to Japan in the 30s, China in the 40s and 50s, Indochina, and so on. It wasn't until the 70s that people suddenly started to realize there was an Asia and an Asia-Pacific that also had to be reckoned in geopolitical terms.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, really, except I am simply trying to tell the story of the Atlantic's history and say it is hugely important. But I mean, the last book I wrote, which was a book about a chap called Joseph Needham, who was essentially the architect or the one who made people realize all of a sudden that China was not a country to be overlooked, that far from China having been on the periphery of civilization, which is what our Atlantic-centric culture persuades us is the truth, far from being on the periphery, China has been at the center of the creation of civilization. I think we've got the message now, but we didn't start to get it until essentially he wrote his book in the first volume of Science and Civilization in China, the biggest book in the English language about China ever written. It was published in 1954. Up to that point, we were unashamedly Atlantic-centric, and we did overlook the realities of the coming Japan and Korea and China. But I think there's no doubt nowadays. However, I think, and this isn't simply because I've written a book about it, I think it's going to be a very, very long time before the primacy of this ocean and the axis of decision-making between Europe and the east coast of North America is toppled from its perch. Yes, we all know China and Japan, or China particularly, vastly important economically, but important culturally, spiritually. I'm still not certain that that's going to happen. I think Euro-American centricity is going to dominate the world for a long time to come. And New Zealand, of course.
Richard Valcourt, you've spoken about the Pacific, you've written about the Atlantic, but there's something in between. And Robert Kaplan was here a few days ago to speak about his new book, Monsoon. He says the Indian Ocean is the one that is essentially the ocean of the future, given what's happening in China and the decline, in some ways, of the West. What do you say about the Indian Ocean?
Well, I'd love the two of us to have a debate about that. I think I cannot agree. I mean, yes, of course, India. I mean, I was the correspondent in India for 3 years. I love India. I go there every year. Clearly, hugely important, but in the world scheme of things, the Chinese premier a few years ago said, you know, the future of the world is that India's the brains and China's the muscle, and between the two of us, we will dominate the world. Well, that may well happen, but people have been talking this way for quite a long time now. I mean, ever since Deng Xiaoping made that remark about to get rich is glorious, The coming economic strength of China, no one doubts it. But whether those two countries are going to have quite the global influence that America and Europe have, which is the position that Kaplan takes, I don't buy it. I mean, theoretically, it's a nice idea, but I just don't think it's going to happen practically. I would love to sit down with him. Maybe you could think on a future occasion we could have a ding-dong debate about him. So it's a nice idea. Well, I don't think it's a nice idea either. It's an idea, but I don't think it's going to happen. Not for a long, long time.
I just want to make sure I haven't missed anyone. Well, you took us on a magical carpet ride. I know it's not the ocean, but thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.